coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
For the animals in our care, we tend to focus on monocultures that are low in phytochemical diversity and then in our own diets. And then, as you say, the downstream effects are huge of that in terms of our health and the health of the animals in our care.
Hey everyone, Dr. Hyman here. I'm so happy when I have the chance to just hang out with my wife at home and cook up something amazing. And one ingredient that I cannot live without every time I cook is avocado oil. This is my go-to oil for any kind of medium or high heat cooking because it has a high smoke point, so it won't burn, it won't destroy the nutrients at higher temperatures. Avocado oil is a great source of antioxidants. It has good fats that actually increase the absorption of other nutrients in your food, like vitamin A and vitamin D. And I love using it to saute some wild-caught salmon, roast a bunch of veggies, or even bake some of my homemade toasted sage butternut pizza from my cookbook. It's honestly good for everything. And because I love this stuff so much, I always make sure it's stocked up in my pantry. My go-to place for healthy shopping is Thrive Market because they make it super easy to order whatever I need and have it delivered right to my doorstep for the best price, like my non-GMO, ethically sourced avocado oil. Now, Thrive offers a 25 to 50% discount on all their items compared to other retailers, and they make it easy to find the right membership for you and your family. You can choose a 1 month, 3 month, or 12 month plan, and each one will save you lots and lots of money on your grocery bills. I know I've saved a ton. Right now, Thrive is offering all Doctor's Pharmacy listeners an amazing deal. You'll get up to $20 in shopping credit when you sign up to spend on all your favorite natural food, body, and household items. And anytime you spend more than $49, you'll get free carbon neutral shipping. So just head over to thrivemarket.com/Hyman. That's thrivemarket.com/Hyman. By now, you all know how I feel about aging and that I'm avoiding all the negative symptoms associated with it by optimizing my diet and lifestyle so I can live a longer, healthy, active life. But one part of aging we don't talk about enough is libido. Now, we shouldn't have to say goodbye to our sexual vitality just because another year has gone by, and that is a key part of our health that deserves attention just like any other. So when I heard red light therapy can support libido, I was super excited to learn more about it. The company called Joovv, J-O-O-V-V, makes several types of red light therapy devices that you can use at home. And they have special LED lights that deliver safe, concentrated light to your skin and cells. It turns out that this type of light may help regulate hormones, which is one of the reasons our libido crashes with age. Studies show red light therapy can increase thyroid hormones and sex hormones like testosterone and progesterone that all decrease as we age. Now, this hormone regulation leads to an increased sex drive. You might have even heard my friend Ben Greenfield talking about this when he was on my podcast recently. He uses Joovv himself and has noticed these exact benefits. We're so lucky to live in a time where we have tools like Joovv's red light therapy at our fingertips to counteract aging. On top of boosting libido, it's also a great way to improve sleep through melatonin production, to increase collagen production for healthier skin, and reduce inflammation at a cellular level. And all you have to do is stand or sit in front of one of their lights for 10 to 15 minutes a day. That's it. If you want to check out Joovv's various red light therapy devices for yourself, just head over to joovv.com/pharmacy. That's joovv.com/pharmacy with an F, F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. It's an amazing addition to any wellness routine to get multiple benefits. Now let's get back to this week's episode. Welcome to The Doctor's Pharmacy. I'm Dr. Mark Hyman, and that's pharmacy with an F, a place for conversations that matter. And if you've ever been curious about the debate between meat, no meat, grass-fed, not grass-fed, about our greenhouse gases, climate emissions, and the impact of all of this, you're going to love this conversation with a legend, Fred Provenza, who's written so much about this for decades. He is my new hero. I didn't really know about him until recently. And then I started reading his stuff and I'm like, how do I not know this guy? He grew up in Salida, Colorado, working on a ranch and attending school in wildlife biology at Colorado State. And he's now professor emeritus in behavioral ecology, which is a great, great subject we can talk about, in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University, where he worked for 35 years. He's really a pioneer in understanding how foraging behavior and animal behavior links soil, plants, herbivores, and humans together. And his work really reminds me of a quote from Sir Albert Howard, who said, "The whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and human is one great subject." And he has tied that together. And his work has really been studying that. He's author of three books, which is great. One is called Nourishment, his most recent book, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom, Foraging Behavior, Managing to Survive in the World of Change, and a number of other books. He's published 300 research papers. I've read three of them so far. I got 297 more to go. And he's also been invited speaker to over 500 conferences. And his recent papers are just so compelling. One of them is called, "Is Grass-Fed Meat and Dairy Better for Human Environmental Health?" His recent ones are going to be published soon, called "Health Promoting Compounds Are Higher in Grass-Fed Meat and Milk." So we're going to talk about what that means. Are there plant-rich compounds that are health protective in animal foods? Are there phytochemicals in animal foods? That is something you should listen to very carefully, because I think the answer will surprise you. And his recent article, "We Are the Earth and the Earth is Us, Linking Land, Food, Heart, and Mindscapes," is just a beautiful philosophical essay on our relationship to the earth and its relationship to us. And one of the things I've often said is what we do to ourselves, we do to the planet. What we do to the planet, we do to ourselves. And this is really the actual quote. It's almost from your article that reflects an ancient Maori proverb. Maoris are the indigenous people of New Zealand, where my wife is from, which is, "I am the land and the land is me." And we've gotten so far away from that. We've got so disconnected from our heritage and our connection to the earth, and it's pretty important. So I'm just so excited to have you, Fred, on the podcast and the Doctor's Pharmacy. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's wonderful to be with you, and what a great overview you gave already.
Well, you know, I've been
seriously.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and you know, there's a lot of topics we're going to cover. We're going to cover the issues around grass-fed meats. Are they healthy or not? How are they impactful for the environment and the climate? We're going to talk about really surprising topics that people haven't maybe thought about, which is, you know, what is the role of plant nutrition in animal nutrition, and how does that affect our health and their health? And what's really, really shocking from what you wrote about in your book is that there are 200,000 wild plants. Only a few thousand are eaten by humans. A few hundred are domesticated, and only 12 account for 80% of our diet, mostly corn, wheat, soy, and rice. And yet our biologies depend on these phytochemicals for their resilience and their health, and we're not eating any of them. And so we're in a pretty bad predicament. And how did you come to think about this bigger topic of phytochemicals in animal foods? Because it's you know, phyto means plant, right? So it's, you're talking about a plant food in animal food, and how does that affect us? How did you even come up with that notion?
Well, it was through no fault of my own, actually. I'll go back in time, and I had not a clue of phytochemicals. I knew about what in ecology we refer to as the primary compounds, energy, protein, minerals, and vitamins. I'd learned about that in my courses during undergrad in wildlife biology. And I ended up going to graduate school and working on domestic goats foraging on this shrub called blackbrush down in southern Utah. Nothing in my mind more boring, actually. I wanted to work on goats, but I wanted to work on wild goats foraging on these diverse arrays of native plants in the high Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Didn't turn out that way. But so I'm working with these goats in southern Utah, and they're doing amazingly interesting and strange behaviors. We were using them as mobile pruning machines during the winter to prune this shrub, which stimulates new growth on the shrub. And we knew that the new growth was higher in energy, higher in protein, higher in minerals. It's better for the goats. Mm. Goats didn't want to eat the new twigs. That's what took me into this whole area that I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about. Well, it turns out that new twigs on blackbrush are highly, what ecologists refer to as highly defended with these chemicals. And I started working with natural products chemists at the University of Alaska and ecologists. And in those days, we were doing what's referred to as bioassays, where you extract and purify compounds and you're searching for the compound that's causing the deterrence. And we did tons of these bioassays and finally decided that it was a condensed tannin in blackbrush that was deterring the goats from eating the new twigs. Well, this opened up this whole area in chemical ecology that was just coming on the scene 40, 50 years ago, about how compounds in plants mediate interactions with plants, with other plants, and with animals in the environment. So it was so timely, and I started to read in that literature, and I said, oh my gosh, it's incredible. One, the number of these compounds that plants produce, literally tens of thousands of them in these broad classes like phenolics, terpenes, alkaloids, each with tens of thousands of compounds. And ecology was, in those years, ecologists were trying to understand what roles do these compounds play. Up to that point, you know, in ecology, we classify these compounds into two broad classes, primary compounds, energy, protein, minerals, and vitamins, and these so-called secondary compounds.
And these are called phytonutrients, right?
Which absolutely are now commonly called phytonutrients. They were historically called secondary compounds because people didn't know what roles they played. And they were thought to be even waste products of plant metabolism by biochemists and physiologists back in the day. You know, it's just reflecting how our knowledge grows and grows and grows. Well, to make a long story short, in the last 50 years, we've come to realize they're not secondary compounds at all. There's papers written with titles such as Primary Roles for Secondary Compounds. What we're realizing is that these compounds are the eyes, the ears, the voice, literally, of plants. They're the ways that they communicate and interact in their environments. So it's just an absolutely fascinating topic that is it's so broad and inclusive, but it's basically about how plants interact with their environments and then the roles that these compounds play in those interactions, in the health of plants, and then, as we'll discuss, in the health of all the creatures that utilize plants. I often think soils is such a hot topic nowadays. And for good reason, absolutely. But I try to remind people every time I speak, you know, plants turn dirt into soil, and communities, diverse communities of plants, turn soil into homes for herbivores, omnivores, and carnivores below ground and above ground. And it's that tremendous diversity of plants that creates the homes. They become the nutrition centers and the pharmacies. And I literally have come to so much appreciate that over my years of working in this area.
Incredible. So basically what you're saying is that there were these seemingly irrelevant compounds that scientists were finding in plants that you call secondary compounds. We now call these phytochemicals or phytonutrients that are in there that are different than protein, fat, carbohydrates, vitamins, and minerals. And they're so devoid in our diet right now. So we really create an agricultural system that's focused on protein, fat, carbs, and calories, not even vitamins and minerals, and certainly not phytonutrients. And that's led to a massively nutritionally deficient animal production system. The animals are deficient in these compounds in their biology, and humans are. And as a doctor, one of the things that's always struck me was that looking at these compounds in human health, I'm like, wow, how do these compounds that come from plants that are essentially their defense and communication systems, how do they interact with our biology to produce so many beneficial effects? And I often think that our biology is very lazy as humans. We only do the things we have to do. We only make the compounds we have to make, and we get the rest from what we eat. But if the average hunter-gatherer is eating 800 species of plants, and we're eating 12 and maybe mostly 4 or 5 in our ultra-processed diet, What are we missing? And what are the implications for that on human health? And I began to realize that these are not just accidental relationships, that there's this phenomena that I came up with this goofy term years ago called symbiotic phytoadaptation, meaning we have adapted in a symbiotic way with the plants to borrow their chemical machinery that we've ignored at our peril to optimize our biology and to create optimal function. They don't necessarily treat disease, but they reduce inflammation, they help detoxification, they're antioxidant compounds, they help our microbiome. All these compounds that you mentioned are so powerful, and we've really created this mono diet. So in your work, you talk a lot about the challenges of our modern agriculture and why it's producing food that's devoid of these things, both for humans and for animals. And particularly in animal husbandry, the mono diets, the feedlot diets that are providing adequate calories, but not enough nutrients and not enough certainly phytonutrients, has a dramatic impact on the quality of the meat. And in your work, you talk a lot about the challenges of the research we have on meat. And there's a lot of studies that show that meat is potentially harmful, that it may increase risk of heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, and death. And yet, and there's other studies that may not corroborate with that. So there's a lot of mixed research, but all those studies are not on grass-fed animals, and they're certainly not on grass-fed animals eating a diverse array of plants. So it's not just grass-fed or not grass-fed. If they eat one kind of grass, it's not great. But if they eat multiple kinds of grass or multiple kinds of plants, then it has a different effect on them. So can you talk a little bit about the challenges of this current form of agriculture and the implications for our health and for the animal health and what we're eating in terms of animal products in this day and age that are not necessarily providing these compounds?
Yeah, everything you said, absolutely spot on related to that. And let me go back and pick up on some of the ideas that you're developing here, starting with this whole idea of how we've simplified our diets, made them virtually, as you say, highly processed, devoid of all these rich arrays of compounds, and how we did that very same thing with the animals in our care.
Yeah.
Well, if you look historically at how ecologists viewed these secondary compounds and as they relate to herbivores, they were viewed as defenses, as deterrents against animal feeding. And so they took on this negative connotation. If you review the literature as I have, and as we were working on projects in agronomy, which is, think about the fruits and vegetables and all the crops we grow, they were viewed as toxins.
Yeah.
And so in both literatures, they took on this very, very negative connotation. So how does that work then? You know, one of the things that we came to understand working with herbivores is that these compounds set a limit on how much of any one food an animal can eat. How do animals get around that? They eat a diverse array of different plant species then. And so you don't swamp detoxification mechanisms in the body. So an animal can maybe eat 50 bites of plants with tannins, another 100 bites of plants with alkaloids, and so on and so forth. But they mix and match all these different compounds. And in so doing, they're exposing cells and organ systems to this vast array of compounds then. And so if you think, I often think of cells and capillaries are kind of like, the capillaries are a stream and the cells can only forage on what's in that stream. And if there's this diverse array of compounds in that stream, if a cell needs a certain kind of whatever compound, it can get that. Because these herbivores are foraging on a diverse array of plants. Well, we simplified their diets, focusing primarily on quantity as opposed to quality. How much can we produce, how quickly? And we certainly did that with all of the domestic species, from chickens right on through. And as a result,
and also plants, right?
Plants, yes, yeah. So that's exactly right, Mark. So we've selected against these secondary compounds with the idea of growth and production. You know, if you realize, and there's an elaborate and very interesting literature ecologically on this as well, there's a cost to producing these compounds. When they were originally viewed as waste products of plant metabolism, thought there's no cost. Well, there's a cost. It takes resources for the plant to make them. And so they're actively synthesized. So if you select against them, you can increase growth at the expense of phytochemistry. But we've also shot ourselves in the foot doing that. We replace, you know, those compounds serve not only as deterrents to larger herbivores to set limits on intake, they prevent insect pests from attacking them. So we make up with all the roles that these compounds used to play with fossil fuel inputs. Our costs do go up, but they're indirect. So we selected against these compounds.
Yeah, you write in your book that the phytochemical richness of plants, fruits and vegetables and grains have declined between 10 and 50% in 43 different plant species that we eat over the last 50 years. I mean, that is just striking to see half of the beneficial compounds in the fruits and vegetables and plant foods we eat are less than 50 years ago, with human implications that are staggering.
Absolutely the case. We've done that. We've, for the animals in our care, we've tend to focus on monocultures that are low in phytochemical diversity, and then in our own diets. And then, as you say, the downstream effects are huge of that in terms of our health and the health of the animals in our care.
Yeah, so we have this incredible diversity that we've lost, and these incredible compounds that we're learning have huge impacts on human health. And it may even be more important than vitamins and minerals, I believe, in some cases, in terms of protective foods. I mean, the whole idea of protective foods. So what's fascinating to me is you write about how these animals have this innate intelligence that they will eat certain plants and they'll eat other plants. And they'll, if they're given the opportunity to navigate themselves based on the flavor and the nutritional and medicinal properties of the food, they will self-select things that make them healthier. And they will self-select things that actually make the quality of their meat and milk far better. How do they do that?
You know, that was the key question. Watching the goats in southern Utah, avoiding the current season twigs that they should be eating. And when I went back and told some of my sainted professors that I very much admired and still do, what was happening with the goats, that they're avoiding these twigs that they should be eating. They're eating wood rat houses. That why would they eat a wood rat house, you know? And I these are just stimulating my thoughts like mad. But when I told the old professors, they said, well, I guess that just goes to show that domestic animals have lost their ability to have nutritional wisdom. They've lost that wisdom. And that was absolutely the thought back in those days. Wild animals still have those abilities. Domestic animals, as a result of the domestication process, have lost that ability. And I think people think about people in that same way, you know, that we no longer have that ability. So I didn't believe that, but I didn't know how on earth would you show that an animal has, that a body has nutritional wisdom. What does that even mean? In those days, people talked about palatability. It was a poorly defined term. Depending which literature you read in, it was defined in different ways. And so I thought, oh, well, what is palatability? And how would you be able to demonstrate that there is this nutritional wisdom of the body? So there are three facets to this wisdom, Mark. And if I were to start into it, if I were to ask you why you like a particular food, you would tell me, I'm certain, as other people do, because it tastes good. And I would say the same thing. And if I ask you, why don't you like a food? It doesn't taste good to me. And certainly taste and odor, potentiated odor, are fundamental to this system, the flavor of the food. But what we learned over 40 years of studies is that there's another component to this that we refer to as feedback. And that feedback is coming from cells and organ systems, including the microbiome. And people are all over this nowadays. The role of the microbiome in changing our liking for foods. Well, it's cells and organ systems, including the microbiome, that are feeding back. And a lot is known about those, just the way feedback occurs, neurotransmitters, peptides, hormones. That's a whole huge topic in and of itself. But it's just to say there's a physiology that underlies that feedback. But what feedback is doing is it's changing liking for the flavor of food as a function of need. That summarizes hundreds of studies, literally hundreds and hundreds of studies that we did with cattle, with sheep, with goats, with other species. But feedback changes liking for the flavor of food as a function of need is really a summary of that.
And what's interesting though, Fred, is in humans, the same phenomenon happens, but in reverse also. So, well, I mean, in both ways, right? So kids, for example, who are iron deficient will eat dirt to get iron, right? Absolutely. Called pica. But also what we learn is that if you're eating ultra processed food, which is 60% of our diet, people eat far more of that compared to a control group that's given nutrient dense whole foods. They'll eat less because they're satisfied. So often people who are overweight or eating processed food are searching for those nutrients, even though they don't know it. So they just eat more of the same junk while becoming more nutritionally deficient. That's what's fascinating to me.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating. And you're absolutely right on what you're saying. And I have some colleagues who've written extensively on that. And they just have a book that just came out. And their hypothesis is that people, it's broader in the sense that you're talking, but that they focus on protein, and they present a lot of evidence that we've over-ingest energy in order to try to meet protein needs. We have mm-hmm. limited amount of protein. My wife and I were at the feed store yesterday. We have some chickens here, and we have some young chicks, and said, well, I can't get the protein concentration that I want. It's a little bit low. Does that matter? I said, no, it won't matter. They'll simply over-ingest that food to meet their needs for protein. They'll eat more energy in order to meet their needs for the protein. And that's that same idea. And there are really many, many studies that have been done with one I'm thinking of where these cattle were deficient in a particular mineral and they were offered a block that contained a mix of many different minerals. Well, they were eating huge amounts of that block, 2 pounds per animal per day. That's enormous amount. Wow. And as it turns out, they were deficient in zinc. And so they were doing just exactly what you said. They're ingesting huge amounts of this. Well, when they started to offer the minerals separately, the animals keyed in immediately on the zinc. And they ate huge amounts of that until they'd rectified their deficit. So that is
fascinating.
It is fascinating. You know, and we did trials. So let's.
So I wish humans could do that. If they were deficient in something, that they would say, I need selenium and I'm going to eat more Brazil nuts, you know, but we don't have that level of intelligence anymore in our diet.
Well, and I think we don't key into that anymore. You know, the food system has so corrupted, corrupted the nutritional wisdom of the body that it's a mess right now.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. Now that it's June, I couldn't be more excited for summer and all my favorite outdoor activities. And that means Father's Day is coming up soon, so it's the perfect time to reflect on the health of men in our lives who we know and love. Now, whether it's a dad, a brother, an uncle, a husband, or a friend, we've all seen a man we care about show up for us in amazing ways, but maybe not take such great care of themselves because they're trying to take care of their family. Since a lack of sleep can lead to lower testosterone, and chronically missing out on chronic good sleep may make it hard to maintain a healthy weight and make it easier to gain weight, this could increase the chronic diseases that we see so much of in our society, things like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Lack of sleep may also lead to multiple kinds of cancer in men, including prostate cancer. It's clear that us guys really need our sleep in order to stay healthy and vital. And now we can actually help the men we love get better sleep with one of my favorite tools that I use myself every single night. The Chili Pad and the Uller System are two really cool gadgets that fit over the top of any mattress and use water to cool the temperature of your bed, which helps lower your internal temperature and trigger deep, relaxing sleep.
Before I tried Chili Pad, the best sleep I had in years was when I went backcountry skiing with my daughter. You're climbing up, exercising, getting pretty hot, and then you sleep in an unheated hut in a sleeping bag, and it's like 30 degrees. I slept like a baby. I'm willing to bet the men in your house like it cooler at night too, but if you're like my wife and tend to run cold, don't worry. These products from Chili allow you to each control your own side of the bed, ranging from between 55 and 115 degrees. Ever since I started using the Uller system, I fall asleep faster, I sleep deeper, and I wake up feeling fully rested. Right now, Chili is offering my audience a really great deal. When you go to chilitechnology.com/Dr. Hyman, you get 25% off the Chili Pad with the code Hyman25 or 15% off Uller with the code Hyman15. That's chilitechnology.com/Dr. Hyman with the code Hyman25 for the Chili Pad or Hyman15 for the Uller. Help Dad get better rest and support his health and longevity in the process with one of these awesome gifts for Father's Day. He's going to love it as much as I do. Now let's get back to this week's episode.
To go back to your point one step further and to link in with some things. So animals in feedlots are fed what are referred to as total mixed rations. And those rations are very high in grain. And
which is not their normal diet.
No, not their normal diet, and certainly not this diverse array of different forage species that we've been talking about. Mm. It's a very simplified kind of diet. The diet is formulated for the average individual, and that's what they're offered throughout this finishing period. A couple of points then to make. We've run studies where we've offered individuals choices of the ingredients that are in the total mixed ration. Mm. So for instance, a ration that's made up of corn silage, barley, and alfalfa that's all ground and mixed together so that the animal can't select. When we offer individuals choices, even of something as simple as that, four choices, what we find is they eat less food, yet they perform just as well as the animals that are fed the total mixed ration. Why? The why relates to what you were saying. Individuals are over-ingesting in order to meet needs for nutrients that they're needing.
That could explain our whole obesity crisis. You know, people are overeating foods that are nutrient depleted to try to get more of the nutrients they need, and it's just an endless cycle they can't get out of.
That's absolutely the case. And it makes one other point, too, that I really want to hit here. You know, we think, I think in nutrition, what are the needs? What are the needs of a person my age, for instance, my sex, my age, and so forth? But, and what that ignores is that no two individuals on this planet are alike. No two have ever been alike. Everyone is different in terms of morphology and physiology, how we're built and how our bodies function. And so when we ran our studies, and particularly during the last 15 years, you made a point to highlight how no two individuals are doing the same thing in our studies. They're all doing something different. So this study with the cattle, no individual ever selected the same foods. No two individuals selected the same combination of foods across that study. No individual ever selected the same foods from day to day. Everyone did their own thing, but they met their needs. And it ended up, as I've been saying, that they ate less food because they were better able to satisfy their individual needs. It's such a critical... So nobody can tell you then, Mark, exactly what you should be eating any more than can tell me. It's a very individualistic relationship with the foods in the environment.
And the problem is we now are having trouble finding the quality food because the quality of our food has gone down so much because of agricultural practices. The yield has gone up. You produce more food, but less quality food. And in your book, Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom, which everybody should get, you talk about the four reasons why food quality is designed. Now, the first one is that plant breeders want more quantity over quality, right? Two, the way we use irrigation and fertilization increases the growth of the starchy component of a plant and doesn't help at all with the phytochemical conditions, which is dependent on the quality of soil. And then also we pick and pack our food before it's ripe, which means it's not really phytochemically dense. And lastly, I think this is surprising to most people, because carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, which is in large part caused by agricultural systems, the protein goes down in the food because carbon dioxide feeds the plant and makes it more starchy. So we're reducing the nutritional quality of our plant. So how have these factors led to us being so disconnected from our innate nutritional wisdom?
Yeah, in every one of those cases you describe, we're really selecting for growth over phytochemical richness, aren't we?
Yeah.
And so all of that leads to foods that are, as we've been saying, are lacking in this phytochemical richness. We have a greenhouse here on our place. It's not great growing conditions here, you know, short growing seasons, and yet we love to have fresh greens. So we've got them growing like mad right now. And so for our evening, late afternoon meal, Sue will go and pick a fresh bunch of kale and various lettuces and herbs that she's growing out there. It's really diverse. And I absolutely love that. I don't even want to put dressings on that, because the flavors are so rich.
Yeah.
The flavors are fabulous. And so why are they fabulous? It goes back to what we're saying. Not only are there rich arrays of primary compounds, there's a diverse array of secondary compounds. And I literally, I'm amazed. I've obviously over the years become very tuned in and aware of this, how satisfying that is for me to, I just love to eat those foods. And it goes back to what we're talking about. Mm. The flavor is wonderful. Why? Because feedback from cells and organ systems is basically altering my liking, increasing my liking for the flavors of those foods. Well, when you do what those four factors that you just described, the food no longer has this rich array of primary and secondary compounds. And so it's no wonder kids don't want to eat their vegetables. You can't blame them.
The flavor is terrible, right?
The flavor is terrible. And so...
And anybody who's grown a tomato plant knows that. You go in your garden, you pick a fresh tomato, and it's like, what is this? I never had this from the grocery store before. And it's like an explosion of flavor.
That's absolutely the case. And so, you know, I know that the concentrations of compounds have gone down in fruits and vegetables, obviously, for the reasons that we're talking about. But still, you know, when you grow foods yourself and you've got even a little garden plot, you know, or whatever it is, you can get varieties that have these rich arrays of compounds, and you can grow them under conditions that stimulate phytochemical richness in them. Mm. And those flavors, it's, you know, in the stores, many times the foods look great, but they have absolutely no flavor. Or in some of the fruits and vegetables I notice now, they'll be sweet, but they're just sweet. Here where my wife and I live now, during the late summer and fall, you can hike in the hills, and you can pick probably 10, 12 different berries as you go. And those berries have, I'm not a food taster or stuff, so I can't, but they have a richness of flavor and a punch to them. It's not just that they have a sweetness, they do, but they have this richness of flavor. Yeah. And you just know that you are getting much more than I laugh. I have an old friend from the days I was on the ranch, and sometimes we'll visit with her. She's in her mid-80s now. We were talking about old varieties of fruits that we used to absolutely love to eat and how you can't get them anymore. I got apples the other day in the store. They were so terrible. I just threw them out in the pasture, and the cows wouldn't even eat them. You know?
Oh, my.
Yeah, so it's reflecting. And I remember years ago working with orchard folks in the Pacific Northwest. We were at that time training sheep not to utilize the trees in their orchards through some techniques that we had developed. But what was most insightful were their discussions of what's happened with the trees that they grow, what's been selected for over their long lifetimes. And so they were describing all of this. And then they said, so this is what we sell for you to eat. But this is what we eat. And they took me to the back of the orchard. And here was the plum tree. And here were the apple trees. And they said, try one of these plums. And it was a richness of flavor that you
I don't know
what you're talking about.
So, Fred, I don't know if you know about Dan Barber and his Row 7 seeds, but he's a chef who said the same thing. There's no flavor in our food anymore, so let's breed for flavor. And he wasn't, as a chef, necessarily breeding for health or for phytochemical richness, but the good news is that flavor causes good health and flavor causes phytochemical richness. So it's a win-win all the way around, right?
Absolutely the case. And those are so interconnected then. Huh? The flavor of food through feedback in response to these primary and secondary compounds gets so intimately linked. So if there is a richness of flavor, that's telling you something. Huh? And in the dishes that we cook, my wife has a dish that comes from France that some friends were here on Monday, and it has some meat in it, lots of vegetables, and lots of herbs and spices. And they were just raving about that particular dish. And they were satisfied. There was so much of the food left. So you think, well, you're raving about it, but you didn't eat much. No, it's the fact that when food is meeting needs, it's so satiating. And it goes back to what we've both been saying, how you eat less because of the richness, phytochemical richness of that, and biochemical richness in the meat, of course, and so forth.
All right, so speaking of meat, let's just change tacks for a minute, because we're talking about plants and phytochemicals and all the medicinal compounds and things that make it taste good, that make it healing. But when most people think about meat, they think about it's bad for our health, it's bad for our climate, it's bad for the environment. And you start asking a question, which is, are grass-fed animals better for your health? What do they contain? And not only any grass-fed animals, because again, if you just feed them on lawn grass, it's not going to work. They need a diverse array. And the more complex their diet, the more complex the phytochemicals are in their body. But this was striking to me that animals, depending on their diet, have different compounds that come from plants in their tissues that you eat and are protective, things like polyphenols and terpenes and carotenoids and alkaloids, all the things that you mentioned, catechins. I mean, there may be in goat's milk that are fed on diverse pastures have as much of these beneficial compounds called catechins as green tea and beans, which is like, what? So eating goat milk can be as beneficial for you as green tea if your goats are eating the right thing. So you aren't what you eat, you are whatever you're eating just ate. And I think this is really an incredible subject that I'd like to go in, because the way we're growing food doesn't do this. And there's been some interesting studies on humans. When they eat different animals, depending on what they ate, their health impacts are really interesting. So let's start at the high level with the conversation about the kangaroo study compared to feedlot meat and what biological effects they have that. Because everybody said meat's inflammatory, it's going to cause all these diseases. But this study sort of blew the lid on that one. Can you talk about that and what we learned from it?
Absolutely, Mark. I retired 11 years ago. We'd been doing all this research on plants and herbivores, and I'd thought often about humans and the relationship with humans, but I had not gotten into the literature on human food selection, nutrition, and health. And I thought, I'm going to do that. And that's going to be an important part of trying to link with the book. And so this was one of the papers out of Australia that I came across. It was published in 2010, and it blew me away. What they were doing was comparing the diets of kangaroos, or the meat of kangaroos that were eating this diverse array of plant species, and realize that in Australia, when you go to the store, you can buy kangaroo meat. There's a whole system they have for harvesting kangaroos in the wild and processing them and getting that meat. So this is really the real meat there in Australia. And they were comparing the responses of people to that meat with cattle that were raised in feedlots. And they were looking at markers, various inflammatory markers. And when I read through the paper, it was amazing. It's like there was no increase basically in any of these inflammatory markers following a meal with the kangaroo meat, whereas the animals, cattle from the feedlot, no very rapid rise and a very long sustained increase in these inflammatory markers. You know, as I read in the literature, I came to realize that anytime we eat a meal, there's an inflammatory response in our body. The degree to which that occurs and how long that lasts is a function of the foods we eat. And here they were showing with meat this total difference. So I wrote to them and I said, you know, this is really amazing. Are you going to do this study in a way that's not what we refer to in science as confounded? We know that diet and animal were confounded. You don't know to the degree to which it's kangaroo and their diet versus cattle and their diet and so forth. So I said, are you going to repeat it with cattle and see what response you get? And they said, no, it's not our interest. The point we're making is if you want to eat meat at all, you should be eating kangaroo.
Good luck if you live in New Jersey.
All right, good luck. And so ever since then, I had, you know, I was moving out of research in those days, but I had in my mind, we need to do studies. Humans need to do studies, because it was clear just from that, and then the more it got into all that we've been talking about, that meat isn't meat, it isn't meat, and grass-fed definitely isn't grass-fed,
Yeah.
The diversity of the diet is going to influence that. And so I talked with different people, and I have a friend who's a doctor here, who's, I think, very much like you, Mark, actually, in his views and approach. And I would talk with him, and I'd say, you know, we need to do studies. Can we do? But that takes a whole setup, right? I mean, you don't just need to do clinical studies with people. You really have to have a setup. And so it took many years, but there's a team in place now, Stephen Van Vliet at Duke. Who's hardcore human nutritionist that's very much on the same page as what we're talking about. Collaborator Scott Kronberg, who's with USDA ARS in Mandan. We have really put together a small team we're submitting many, many proposals to really start to do research. We've done a little bit. Stefan has been doing metabolomics work to try to, metabolomics is a way to try to get a handle on the diversity of compounds that are in a particular, in meat in this particular case here, to compare meat from a monoculture diet versus different diversities of diet. So we've done some work like that, but what we really want to do is to get involved in clinical trials looking at responses of people to meats that vary phytochemically.
But some of the preliminary data is interesting, where you look at the blood levels of certain of these phytochemicals in people who eat animals that have diverse diets that are foraged, actually finding these compounds in the blood of humans. This is the metabolomics work you're doing. So there's preliminary evidence that this is actually happening, that you're eating animals that eat a rich diet of plant foods from foraging on special types of regenerative or grass-fed farms, and they're actually seeing those compounds in the blood of these humans and also the effects on their biology. And that's striking to me.
It is. It's amazing. And it really points to the linkages, does it not? Of soil, plant diversity, the diets of animals, the diets and the health of those animals, and then to us as well, and to how deeply interconnected all of that is. And I think in the past we simply didn't appreciate how intimately linked we are with the environments we inhabit, and this is just another way of illustrating that. And you know, I in visits with Stefan, and I see this not as one study to be done. I see this as 10 to 20 years of studies that really fleshes out the implications of this and what it is and how it works. Just like 45 years ago when we started, and I remember I was telling a professor, I said, I really want to study the role of learning in food and habitat selection. Mm. I said, you know, you could do a neat little study that rules out genetics and so forth. Well, it wasn't one little study. It was 40 years of research that was looking at all these facets and trying to describe the elephant, trying to move away from just single factor one study to really looking at the richness. And that's how I see this, is that there's a whole world to be explored. And when you know, one of the things that we found over and over again is that everything that's in the diet of an animal is influencing its response to anything else that gets introduced into that diet. So what we would refer to as the basal diet is fundamentally important in any response that you're going to get. Well, nowadays, one of the interesting responses, I think, is if you compare people that are on the Western ultra-processed diet and their responses to meats of different biochemical and phytochemical richness to people that aren't. It's the way the researcher in me starts to think, well, what are some key kind of studies that could be done initially to start to move your way into this? And there's reasons to believe that, you know, when you're on the ultra-processed diet, you're going to have a totally different response compared to when you're on a really wholesome diet of fruits and vegetables and meats. And so I think it's just my way of trying to say there's such a rich array of studies that could be done.
So just to highlight some of the amazing things you said, because it's worth pointing out, is that one, animal foods fed diets that are rich in a diverse array of plant species, which they self-select based on their needs for their nutrition and for the healing properties, end up having much higher concentrations of these in their meat and their milk, which do have consequences for human health. And while there isn't a huge amount of data, there's enough there to go, wait a minute, we're seeing the biological effects. And that brings into question this big debate about meat, no meat. It's a very oversimplified debate because most of the studies that have been done are on feedlot meat in our diet, not these kinds of diverse diets that aren't just even grass-fed, but that are regenerative. We'll talk about that in a minute. And so all of a sudden we're like, wait a minute, maybe our notions about the health effects or the harm from meat are not really well sorted out because we haven't done the right research on these benefits of grass-fed regenerative meats. And the hypothesis is that it actually is much better for us and it may help with protecting us against certain diseases and reducing inflammation and increasing antioxidants in the food and increasing the kinds of quality fats that we need, like CLA. So all of a sudden, we've got this incredible opportunity to rethink our approach to meat. So I think that's an important point. The second thing that I think are in people's minds is, okay, well, two questions. One, what about the environmental impacts of all this meat? What about the increasing consumption of meat across the world and the demand? And grass-fed sounds nice, but one, it's not scalable. And two, what about all those methane burps from the cows? Aren't those terrible? And isn't that going to create climate change as well? So maybe we really can't win. So we should be just reducing meat overall or eliminating meat. And you talked about some of the challenges with the Eat Lancet report that sort of said we should all be having 90% less meat in our diet. So can you talk about first the issues around the scalability of this and the fact, and you talked about this, I mean, you talked about how there's 432 billion kilograms of inedible food for humans that gets upcycled and upgraded into high quality nutrient dense animal food that we couldn't otherwise eat. And then you also talk about the potential for scalability of this across different landscapes. So can you talk about that first?
Absolutely the case. So many things come into my mind.
Sorry, I gotta go deep.
Let's go back to where, to one of the points you made, and then we'll spring forward. I think what Eat Lancet was talking about, there's certainly some valid points there. And what we need to, I think, discriminate, or people generally need to discriminate, is there's a certain system that was adapted after World War II for how livestock, we moved away from pasture finishing of animals, which was the common way, and toward this feedlot model. And so that has to do with ways of producing feeds that are fed in the feedlots, the high grain diets that animals are on, That has to do, so that creates a certain kind of agriculture based on monoculture crops and high inputs of fertilizers, pesticides, gone to GMO. So that's one system that produces, that's produced tremendous amount of red meat in the country. And it's so important to distinguish that then, as we've been alluding to, from a system that's pasture-based, and where animals will be coming from pastures, hopefully with diverse mixtures of plants, and then from rangelands as well. That's where I spent my career working, was really on rangelands. And this whole issue of grazing and methane burps and all the rest of that gets so intimately tied with this. And again, not to take us too far down this path, but grazing isn't grazing isn't grazing. You know, grazing, especially in the wildlife literature, has a very negative connotation. And that connotation came from the way that animals were allowed to free range at the turn of the century and the early part of the, I'm talking about the last century and the part of that century. And there was a lot of degradation of landscapes. There's no question about it. Too many cattle, too many sheep grazing year-round, overgrazing plants.
But not wild, not wild food, right? Because there were 165 million ruminants roaming around America,
right.
Buffalo,
right.
And antelope and elk and deer. And now we have 95 million animals and we're seeing all these climate impacts, and then we weren't.
That's absolutely the case. So what all has happened? Well, you know, what we've learned through this discipline called range science is that grazing isn't grazing isn't grazing. When grazing is properly managed, when animals are moved around landscape in ways simulating movements of wild animals. Wild animals didn't just stay put. They follow the green up the hillsides in our part of the country. You know, now in the winter, they're all in the bottoms. Thousands of elk are in this valley where we live, this Madison Valley. They're going to move. They're starting to move already. They follow the green vegetation. They'll end up in Yellowstone National Park. So animals are moving around landscapes. When we confine them to landscapes, we put them in a box. So this ability of animals to move becomes very important for the health of the animals and for the health of the plants and the plant communities. That's what range science was really about, is how you manage grazing in ways so that you encourage biodiversity of plants, diverse arrays of grasses and forbs and shrubs and tree species, each with different rooting depths and abilities to fix carbon. So this winds us back around to this idea that, well, it's part of the system, and what we really want to do is to manage grazing in ways that encourages biodiversity of landscapes and the health of all these plants. You know, if you think about plants, most of the plant is below ground. 3/4 of the plant is below ground. Now, what do you see when you overgraze a plant? At the what you see above ground is less and less growth on the plant. If you could look below ground, the root systems are vanishing. They're diminishing.
Yeah.
You have nothing there. That's one of the arguments that people make for, if we manage grazing properly, we can fix more carbon across landscapes. And it's valid. And if you start to think beyond...
I mean, that's called regenerative agriculture, right?
That's what. That's the term.
Because you regenerate soil. You regenerate biodiversity. You regenerate water systems.
Absolutely the case. Healthy system. And if you realize that these different plant species each have different kinds of roots and different rooting depths, you start to realize there's potential for these different species to fix different amounts of carbon. If you start to appreciate shrubs as a part of systems as well, so little trees, you start to realize there's potential to fix carbon long term in those soils. So that's one benefit that can be attained if we start to think about grazing systems, moving away from agriculture as we've done that in terms of animal production, start to think about how can we create biodiverse pastures and farming systems that incorporate livestock, incorporate their manure and feces, which is the natural way that landscapes were fertilized by animals.
Yeah. What's also fascinating, Fred, I'm just going to trip you for a sec, is that in the plants also affect the soil. So when you have a diverse array of plants, They're putting different nutrients in the soil, and they're helping the soil extract different nutrients to the plant in this incredible cycle that ends up upgrading the quality of the nutrition that the animals eat. So it's this incredible cycle, and it's such a beautiful thing. And it's almost like, you know, having a buffet of different plants for the animals, all feeding different levels of nutrition and have different properties, but it's also feeding the soil in a way that generates better soil.
Absolutely the case. And if you realize that there are herbivores, omnivores, and carnivores below ground, you can classify, you know, and when you have diverse rays of plants, you're creating homes for all those different features to interact with one another, and the potential then in terms of climate change to fix carbon dioxide in those communities, and not just short term, but longer term. Then let's go to these secondary compounds. Let's talk about tannins and terpenes just a little bit. When ruminants have tannin-containing species in their diet, that reduces methane emissions. Those tannins reduce methane emissions. Some of them are methanogenic. They also, by the way, tannins interact with compounds like proteins and carbohydrates when they get into the digestive system. They totally change outcomes. They also create feces and soil that's more recalcitrant to breakdown, so that they're fixing carbon long-term in those soils. I read a lot about, and I chuckle, and it makes me a little frustrated, you know, about seaweed as a possibility for put seaweed in the diet.
Yeah.
Reduce methane emissions. And most recently I've read about activated charcoal as a way, and certainly not to take away from those. But what I would like to hear everybody say is, look, tannin-containing plants are everywhere. You have Forbes, you know, like...
So Forbes are like flowering plants, like sunflowers.
Flowering plants, yeah. That's what people would like to go, you know, like the petunias.
Yeah, those are Forbes, because I never heard of Forbes. I'm a doctor, but I looked it up, and it's like a sunflower and flowering plants.
Yes, for me, it's a term that's so much a part of you. It would be like using some of your specialized terms.
Yeah.
Don't know about, but... They're the flowering plants. Right now on our little place here, we have a lot of native vegetation on our acre and a half. Phlox is a plant that people grow. The little native phloxes, all their pretty little blossoms are flowering. The local weeds are starting to flower. The larkspur, all those are the forbs.
So what you're saying essentially is that certain plants have these phytochemical compounds like tannins that reduce methane emissions.
Absolutely,
dramatically. What's also fascinating is that, you know, we talk about the feedlots driving climate change, which they do, and we talk about methane emissions being such a big issue. But it turns out that livestock only is responsible for about 5% of methane emissions. Rice paddies are about 3%. So maybe you shouldn't eat rice, and we need to fix how we grow rice. That's another issue. And that even worse is food waste, which produces 16% of the methane emissions. So maybe we shouldn't be eating vegetables that we throw in the landfill or whatever. You know, like there's all these arguments. So I think maybe the vegetables that we throw out and the food waste and the rot are actually driving far more, maybe 3 or 4 times more methane emissions than the feedlot animals. And what you're saying is with the range fan animals, they can even have less methane emissions. And they're also a methanotropic bacteria in the soil, if it's cultivated properly, that fix methane into the soil. Is that right?
Absolutely the case. Absolutely.
Not bad for a doctor, right?
No, you're doing fantastic. It's music to my ears, Mark. To hear. I think you are the doctor of the future. Have to think ecologically, seriously, yes. You know, and ecologically about all of these issues. And
okay, so getting back to the
very nice perspective when you start to talk about, you know, termites would be another one, right? Should we get rid of all the termites on the plant that are producing tons of, but that puts it in a what you said puts it in a perspective, in a broader perspective, and then we can think about, you know, and one of the arguments that's popping into my mind too of, you know, well, it takes longer for animals to finish. What if they're not in feedlots? Regardless of how a person looks at that, when the diets of animals grazing on landscapes, when you have grazing in ways that create high quality diets for animals, when you have tannin containing plants in those diets, you know, animals satiate quickly, they gain, they perform, to put it in a feedlot term, they perform, they gain well because
yeah.
being provided, and you get away from all the antibiotics. Why? Because that's what's in the plants. That's,
yeah.
that's creating the health for them, all these diverse array of compounds. So it moves toward a very...
So I think people would say these are nice ideas, but how can we scale this? I mean, you know, we raise so many animals in this country. How can we do that at scale with managed grazing and regenerative agriculture? I mean, we need to feel a growing world. There's going to be 9 billion people. Everybody wants more meat. Is this realistic? And how do you answer that question?
Yes, I think that's a very, very important and a very valid question. I know of groups that are really working that have broad reach, broad scope. And I very much encourage and work with groups. The holistic management group of folks, I think, are really trying to, and there are many, many subgroups that are trying to get word out, trying to get changes to occur. But that's a major issue. And it's tied, in my mind, in part two here in the United States with how much meat we eat. You know, when I was a youngster growing up, we never ate. I never had a steak ever. And I'm not crying poor boy or any of those kind of things. We could not afford to have that. We had a little bit of hamburger. We ate not so much meat, but we probably ate the amount that we needed for us to grow and to be healthy. And over again, people make the point that for here in the U.S., we're probably consuming way more meat than what we actually need to. If you think then of what we're saying about, well, where does that meat come from? And what about phytochemically and biochemically rich meat as a part of that? It's probably a true statement that we can reduce the amount of meat that we eat. I also think so much, I speak very often at these organic and agriculture, you know, regenerative ag conferences. There's so many young people at those conferences, so many young people that are wanting to become involved in agriculture. How do we create an infrastructure that enables those people to get on landscapes and to work on landscapes and to integrate animals with those landscapes? I think of this this documentary I watched, The Biggest Little Farm, and I don't know if you've seen that or not, but I think that's a wonderful illustration of how
Alan Williams, you know, really has done the math on this, and he said, you know, there's 29 million grain-fed cattle consumed every year from factory farms. And he said, if we take idle grasslands, including like USDA Conservation Reserve Program land that is not great for farming but good for grazing, if we convert some of the corn and soy monocrops used for fattening feedlot cows, we could produce 52.9 million grass-fed head of cattle, which is almost double what's produced in feedlots. So if we're smart about what we're doing and we use the right types of agricultural practices and take all the lands that we're not using now and convert some of the lands that we are using for growing feedlot feed, we could literally have almost double the amount of cows. So I think it's not a fair argument. I don't know if it's his facts are all right, but I think it's, I would challenge people who would say that we can't scale this.
Absolutely the case. Absolutely the case. And so then it's a question of how do people, we get people on board, huh? And, you know, perhaps some of what's happening right now with the coronavirus and the pandemic and what's happening, you know, we were at Costco yesterday, and they're limiting the amount of meat that you can buy there at that Costco because it's not available. Well, that gets you thinking more on a local scale as well, huh? When I was a young boy growing up, everyone grew gardens. That everybody, all those people that had come from other countries, you know, who had immigrated over, including my relatives, they all had little gardens, they all raised chickens, they all had a few animals around. You know, that makes, that changes all that as well, gets it very local. And then as we've been saying, I think, you know, I went to Utah State University years ago because I had this ranch background, where I saw what was happening on ranches and thinking, you know, that's pretty neat, that contact with landscape. I'd been in wildlife biology at Colorado State University, and the wildlifers hated ranchers. They hated grazing, basically. You know, they only saw the bad in that. Well, here's this program where they're saying, we are using domestic animals to improve habitat for diverse arrays of wild species. And I thought, that's where I want to be.
Yeah.
Because that's illustrating how we can use domestic animals to enhance the health of ecosystems from soil, through plant diversity, through diverse arrays of wild species, and as we're talking now, right on up through human health. So again, realizing those linkages and the important roles that cattle, sheep, goats can play nowadays in these ecosystems is very important.
And I think what's interesting is how do you navigate that argument that if we did this at scale, could it be the opposite of contributing to climate change? Could it be the answer to climate change? And in your articles, you talk about how of the 80 solutions to draw down carbon out of the environment, when you combine all the regenerative agricultural solutions from managed grazing to silvopasture, which is introducing animals into, for example, trees, like having chickens eat walnuts, or like in Spain, they did it with the black-footed pigs that make incredibly nutritious and delicious meat that because they're eating the acorns from trees. If you did that, and if you did all these other practices, that you could literally have the number one solution for climate change. So it's almost the opposite of what people are saying, that in fact, an integrated ecological system, integrating plants and animals in a robust regenerative system, could literally be the solution instead of the cause for climate change.
Absolutely the case. And that's where I think the general public needs to more and more come to discriminate the conventional system since World War II of how we're producing beef and chicken and all the rest of those things versus what we're talking about, which is an entirely different way to think about our relationship with the landscape and the animals that we're producing from that.
It's so true. I mean, the other really cool thing that I kind of learned from reading your work was sort of unexpected. So one, there's the phytochemicals and protective compounds in animal products that eat a certain almost natural diet of wild plants. And two, there's the cultural habits of certain cultures that actually introduce various compounds in the cooking of meat so that it diminishes any adverse effects. For example, in Morocco, they have much lower rates of cancer, and it's all the spices they use. The Maasai, who eat only meat and milk, use 28 spices in their meat cooking and 12 spices in their milk. How does that impact the effects on human health? And should we be having a big array of spices that we consume? And personally, I have a giant spice drawer that's literally this big. And it's huge. It's probably like 3-4 feet across by 2 feet deep. And it's completely full. And I use it all the time. So how does that impact what happens to human health and the meat and some of the adverse effects?
Absolutely the case, what you're talking about. And that's such a fascinating area to think about. So we think about process. We often think about meat in general as being not good for our health, not good for the health of climate, as we've been saying. And then we think of processed meat as even worse, right? You have all these carcinogenic kind of compounds that are in there to nitrates, nitrites, and so forth. And then here's this study comes out of Morocco, this case-controlled study where they're taking people recently diagnosed with colorectal or colon or rectal cancer, and then they're comparing them with people that are not, and looking at diet and lifestyle kinds of things. And they reviewed many, many factors and considered many factors in their analysis related to lifestyle and then, of course, to diet. But one of the really important findings was that there was a strong inverse association between processed meat and colorectal and colon cancer. And that,
wow.
Which kind of blows
you off. Meaning the more processed meat you ate, the lower your risk of cancer.
Right.
How does that make sense?
But then they said, okay, but look, they don't process meat the way that we process meat in Western countries, but they're starting to do that, and they're seeing an increase then in these
cancer.
And they're saying historically, what they use olive oil, they use this diverse array of herbs and spices, and that's probably very, very important. They have the association there that's strong and highly significant, And then they're trying to think from a mechanistic standpoint, why could that be the case? And they're talking about these rich array of herbs and spices and all their anti-carcinogenic, immunomodulatory, and on kind of responses, and saying that's probably playing a really important role in this. And then that winds us back. In that review paper we did, it's a hypothesis paper, right? We're really waving our arms and trying to pull together circumstantial evidence to say this is worth studying. That's all. And one of the ways we did that was to say, look, when herbs and spices are added to meat, it counters these effects, and there's a literature on that. Why do I like drinking red wine with meat? And polyphenols in that red wine are countering alleged adverse effects in the meat. And I like that combination. And is saying, you know, this is a good cells and organ systems is how I would view it, are feeding back to say this is a good combination of things to do. And so
the science on that, just to stop you for a sec, is really interesting, because there's something called malondialdehyde, which is a marker of oxidative stress, or, you know, basically oxidation, which is what hurts people and causes aging. And you can reduce, by having meat with red wine, you can reduce that malondialdehyde, or MDA, by 75%. And also, I think the other thing people don't realize is that when we're looking at the typical American diet, people are eating meat with lots of junk, with lots of starch and sugar. They're not eating meat as part of a diet that's full of an array of vegetables and fruit and phytochemicals and herbs and spices, which totally changes its impact on our health. So a lot of the studies we have are epidemiological studies, and they're not so reliable because they don't really distinguish these factors. And they look at, you know, meat as an independent factor and not considering what you ate the meat with. And my favorite study is when I looked at meat eaters and vegetarians who shopped at health food stores, meaning they both probably had a better quality diet, their risk of death for both groups reduced in half. And it was the same because of what they were eating with the meat or not.
Absolutely the case, and beautifully said, Mark, by the way. That's it. And that's where earlier, when I was saying, you know, when we launch into some of these clinical trials, assuming we can get some funding to do that, I think the basal diet becomes very, very important in terms of looking at the response. You know, if you're on a highly processed Western diet, that's setting you up. That's a certain kind of basal diet, right? That generalizes across so much that's happening not only in our country, but now worldwide, versus a really wholesome diet. You can expect two totally different kinds of responses. Huh? So that's just fundamental to the whole work as far as I'm concerned. And yeah. Even though we can argue, and certainly it's the case nutrient content, both primary and secondary compounds of fruits and vegetables, and when we look at poultry or pork or beef, that all that has declined, still I think a person is better off eating those kind of wholesome foods. And if you get into that, figuring out what are the best ones, what are the best varieties, blah blah blah. You know, it's amazing. My wife won't even eat a chicken anymore, and she hasn't for years. And it's because there absolutely is no, and when you get into that literature, they talk about how these different, what they might call disease states that are produced as a result of the very, very rapid growth. And it's what we were talking about on plants earlier. You dilute this rapid growth and very short lifetime. There is no richness to that meat. And so one of the issues we get into, though, that I think about a lot, this whole nutritional wisdom idea, I'm going to go back up here just a second. So there are three paths to nutritional wisdom of the body. We've talked about flavor feedback and those relationships. We've talked about the second one, the availability of alternative foods and how you learn to utilize those foods. So fundamentally important. That's where we've gotten off track in our, you know, in the U.S. on these highly processed diets. The third part is learning in utero and early in life what's food and what's not food. And we did so much studies of that. You know, the fetal taste system's fully functional during the last trimester of gestation. So the young fetus, the foods that are in mom's diet, the flavors of those foods are getting into the amniotic fluid. So in a way, a young fetus is already starting to experience what's food, what's not food. After birth, flavors of foods get into mother's milk. Just what we're talking about on phytochemical richness and that getting into milk and dairy products. And then mother is a model of what and what not to eat and where and where not to go. All these become fundamentally important. Well, we're no different from that. And there's a rich literature on a lot of the research we did. There's not a rich literature in humans on that. But there is a rich literature on these experiences in utero and early in life. And you know,
so if your mom's eating Skittles, then you're going to want Skittles when you're born.
Goodness, and you're already born pre-diabetic, you know, and all this is influencing gene expression. This whole
area. Epigenetics, right?
Gene expression is being influenced by these experiences in utero and early in life. And so, but now think of a person here that's been raised on grain-fed beef. That was the whole, I remember that buzzword back when I was a kid, grain-fed beef. And a lot of my friends from other countries think it's the most bland, boring thing you could eat. There is no flavor to that. And it's the same with the poultry. It's the same with, and again, that goes back to what's being fed. And so one of the things I'm trying to move toward here is that to get people to start to appreciate what that richness means in terms of the flavor of food. And it might be, you know, sometimes people say, well, I don't like to eat game meat because it's too strong. And that's reflecting our experiences. There have been some really neat studies done in different countries to show that if people are born and raised on grain-fed animals, they prefer that to pasture-fed and vice versa. Yeah. It's the experiences that start to shape what you see as food. They can change as a function of need. And so if you get your diet right, and you start to need what's in that, your body will come around to that. So it can change. But I think back to my years as a hunter, and anybody who's hunted a lot, you know that the season of the year and what foods the animals are on are influencing the flavor of that. And I think specifically about blue grouse, these beautiful blue grouse that occur out here in the West. And during the fall of the year, they're eating a really rich mixture of different plant species, fruits and vegetables, so to speak. As you get into late fall, they move into these Douglas fir trees, and they're eating the Douglas fir needles. And when you shoot an animal at that time of the year, there's a subtle hint of terpene. So there you go. There's the flavor of the diet right there in your face.
Yeah.
And I often thought, you know, this could probably bring high dollars at a restaurant, this little thing. But you would need to get your palate to learn to appreciate that, right? The terroir. When I have a very good friend in France that I've worked with for years, and his work has been to study shepherds and shepherding practices, and to realize that during the day, the animals that they're shepherding have many, many courses to the meals. They're eating diverse arrays of plants and not just eating the best and leaving the rest. They're learning to mix all these different plant species to improve the health of ecosystems, the health of animals. But each one of those people, we met many, many of the farmers there, have their own mix of plants. And so there's a terroir that comes from each unique landscape. And they milk their own animals. They make their own cheese. And so you go to the market and you mix, well, I really prefer Gascon's, you know, dairy product to Michel's or to, it picks up that flavor. And it's like with the wines. And so the palates really come to appreciate this diversity of landscapes. And maybe you do have different preferences that reflect a whole array of things. But, you know, now it's a kind of a one-size-fits-all blandness.
Yeah,
that's in that I so think true. As a culture we need to come to if we make these transitions to come to appreciate richness of flavors and different flavors that can be. But at first I could see a lot of people saying
if you're used to eating, you know, pure sugar and eat a blueberry, it doesn't taste very good. But if you stop sugar for a few weeks and eat a blueberry, it tastes very sweet. I think that's very true.
That's absolutely the case. And if you eat a blueberry when you're really hungry at the beginning of the meal, even if you don't even have sugar in your diet, it's going to taste sweeter than at the end of it. Yeah,
that's right.
That's that feedback, altering liking as a function of what you're moment to moment.
So I'm going to close with a couple of thoughts. One is you wrote one of your articles about this concept of a farmer as an ecological doctor. And I think of myself as a doctor who's an ecologist for human health, and it's all connected. And I think that you have been the most important guest I've had on the Doctor's Pharmacy, because it's pharmacy with an F, F-A-R-M-A-C-Y, meaning that we need to think about the food we eat as a source of our medicine. And food is medicine. And this is exactly what we've been talking about the whole time. And I just want to share a quote from your article, it's just one of the most beautiful sort of philosophical musings on our condition in this moment in history. We are the earth and the earth is us, linking land, food, heart, and mindscapes. And I think if we all paid attention to this, the world would be a lot better. And the quote goes like this: what we do to one another and the plants and animals on earth we do to ourselves. And if we hope to survive, we must mend broken linkages that separate us from one another and the other inhabitants of the earth. And that requires empathy and sympathy for all life. While not doing so could be our undoing, doing so could transform our collective consciousness into one that respects, nourishes, and embraces our interdependence with life on earth. That is just so beautiful, Fred. I just can't say how much that resonates with me. And I think if people paid attention to these interdependencies and interlinkages, all the things we've been talking about, the magic of nature, the magic of how all of our food and our biology is interdependent, and the animals, the plants, and the humans, and the soil, it's really the sort of summation of my life's work. And clearly you've been at this a lot longer than I have. And I'm just so, so happy to have had you on the Doctor's Pharmacy podcast.
Mark, it's been absolutely wonderful for me. I tell you, I'm obviously retired at the end of my career, but when I see people like you and I see what you're doing and what you're talking about, I just think that's the hope. That's the hope for the future. And I guess if I could do one thing, and I saw this as one of your questions at the end, if you could do one thing, what would you do? I would really hope that people would get in touch with this. And one way to do that, I often think of all the resource we use to grow lawns, these lawns throughout our properties. And I think, you know, if we could look at the amount of lawn that we grow, have your little bit of grass, but start to grow vegetable, herbal, medicinal gardens. If everybody would start to reconnect with that. And then around your land, I know this is really dreaming, but more generally, so on our acre and a half here in Ennis, we have a little bit of lawn that's totally been colonized by clover. So we don't need to fertilize. The lawn is very green, but it's the clover fixing the nitrogen from the atmosphere that's fertilizing them. But most of the place is just native vegetation. This rich array of grasses and these forbs I've been talking about.
Yeah.
Berry producing shrubs like crazy. And to me, there's a beauty to that. There's an incredible beauty to that diversity. And the beauty is you don't have to do anything. It grows naturally. You don't have to irrigate it. You don't have to fertilize it. You don't have to put pesticides and herbicides on it to keep it in place. All you have to do is appreciate its beauty. And I often think, you know, if we could get to that point, and I realize for me, I didn't start out anywhere at that point. When I took the first class I did in plant identification, I was absolutely, absolutely blown away that this whole world existed that I had been walking in, kid, hunting and fishing and all that stuff. I'd never seen it. I had never, ever seen that. It's like, oh my gosh, these plants are just fabulous. And I know that would take a total transformation of
life. I don't think so. I mean, we actually had Victory Gardens. 40% of Americans were, I mean, 40% of the food in America was grown by Victory Gardens in World War II. I think we need that again.
And maybe coronavirus is an opportunity for us to, it's a way that we could each reconnect in with the landscape and do what you were just talking about in that quote. Huh?
That is a great idea. Everybody during the lockdown here, summer's coming. Let's grow gardens as a way of nourishing ourselves, nourishing the planet, and actually doing so much good for our mental health and physical health at the same time. I think it's a great, great magic wand that you've just laid on us. So thank you so much, Fred, for being on The Doctor's Pharmacy. If you love this podcast, please share it with your friends and family on social media. Make sure you check out Fred's book, Nourishment. Check out his papers and articles. We'll link to them in the show notes. Share this with your friends and family. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time on The Doctor's Pharmacy. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Hyman. Thanks for tuning into The Doctor's Pharmacy. I hope you're loving this podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do and introducing you all the experts that I know and I love and that I've learned so much from. And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter. And in it, I share my favorite stuff from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger longer. Now back to this week's episode.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.